Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference of four of America's top news reporters. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. The foreign aid program is building up here in Washington as one of the most controversial issues of our day. Recently, a committee of distinguished citizens has been organized to resist communist aggression by promoting the mutual security program. Its chairman is a noted scientist, Dr. Vannevar Bush, who is our guest today. The organization is called the Committee to Strengthen the Frontiers of Freedom. Its formation comes at a time when Congress is considering President Eisenhower's foreign aid program of nearly $4 billion. Dr. Bush has been called the Dean of American Scientists. During World War II, he made a notable contribution by serving as the director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. The organization mobilized scientific effort and directed the early stages of the atomic bomb project. Dr. Bush is a leader in the cause of education. He is the former chairman, now honorary chairman, of Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He also served for 16 years as the president of the Carnegie Institution. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Dr. Bush, are Edwin Dale of the New York Times, Peter Edson of Newspaper Enterprise Association, Roscoe Drummond of the New York Herald Tribune, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Dr. Bush, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Bush, in a recent article, John Hollister, former head of Mutual Security, said that when he was in charge of Mutual Security, he was always guided by a single aim, and these were his words. Will the spending of money for this purpose increase the security of the United States? His sole concern was the self-interest of the United States. Do you agree that our foreign aid should be based solely on our self-interest?
I certainly do. That's the purpose for which this committee has joined itself together, because we believe that mutual security is an essential part of the defense of this country. And, incidentally, one of the best means that we could adopt for preventing war so that we might live in peace.
Well, now, Dr. Bush, using self-interest as a basis, can you justify the continuance of a program of $3.9 billion a year when our budget is so hard to balance and our own defenses seem not so secure?
I can justify it because, in the first place, while I think we need to balance our budget, while we need to be sure that we don't run into inflation, I do not want to see that done by cutting on things that I think are essential for our defense. For to me, defense and peace come first, and they come ahead of many other things that are desirable in this country but not essential. That, to me, is essential.
Now, if you have to make a choice, though, between the balancing of our budget and the spending for mutual security, which risk would you take?
I'd do both. There's no reason why we can't do both.
You'd both balance your budget and you'd spend for mutual security. Well,
right.
That may be quite a trick, though, if you have to make the choice, though.
Look, our spending for mutual security is 1% of our gross national product. As I look around this country, as I see the automobiles that we have and the television sets and so forth, I have no defeatist attitude on this thing. We're still a vigorous country, and we're a rich country. And we can do both and do it effectively. We just got to get to work and do it.
Mr. Drummond.
Dr. Bush, it's probable that the real problem you'll face is the state of public opinion on this question of our mutual aid program and the economic aspects of it. Now, individually, the members of the Joint Chiefs have testified that they consider the mutual security program an essential military weapon. But it seems, I think, to nearly every correspondent in Washington that the military program is so surrounded with secrecy that we can't get enough facts on which to have any kind of independent appraisal. And the question I want to ask you is, how is it going to be possible for your committee to sell the American people on the mutual security program when we can't have the facts on which independent judgment can rest?
One of the best things, one of the wisest things that this country ever did was when the Marshall Plan was put into effect. There isn't any question that it had the hearty endorsement of the great majority of the American people. to an extent that I think was magnificent. They understood. They wanted to have it done. They were willing to be taxed to have it done. They believed in it. I believe in the same way that if they have a real grasp of where we stand now, their enthusiasm and their support will be up to that. Now on the second part of your question, there are some things we don't want to tell the Russians. I think we err in telling too much. There have to be secrets. There has to be classified material. And what do? We get the best professional people we can get through our democratic process, by appointment by an elected president, who have access to all of the facts. And to a very considerable extent, we have to depend on their professional judgment.
Well, I'd like to ask this other aspect of the same question then, Dr. Bush. We are all familiar with the broad generalities in defense of the program, namely that we buy defense less expensively than we could if we were spending the dollars on our own weapons. Now, I wondered if you could take a concrete country, whether it's Pakistan or Korea or any other country, and demonstrate to us or document this generality in a way that people can understand.
Well, I think we can take a very large question, which is, why do we continue to send military aid to Europe? We sent economic aid there long ago. Today we're sending military aid only. Why do we send them modern weapons made in the United States? There's a very good reason for that. We might give them the plans and let them make their own, but we can't take the time. The lead time on a complicated missile is several years under the best of circumstances. A new model of an airplane takes 4 or 5 years before it can be produced. This is a matter of urgency. If we want Europe to be thoroughly armed with modern weapons, as we do for our own defense, as we do so that Russia wouldn't dare to start a war, then the best way that we can do that is to see that they get those weapons from us until they can make their own.
Mr. Edson.
Dr. Bush, is your organization going to register as a lobbyist for Congress?
Well, many of the members of this organization, the men who were instrumental in getting it together, were members of the committee which you remember called the Committee on the Present Danger. And in that particular instance, one of our members did register, with the comment that it was not necessary under the law, but in order to be sure that all proprieties were taken care of, he registered. And we'll do the same thing this time.
Is your organization just for any foreign aid program, or are you going to have a program of your own balanced as to economic and military aid?
Our committee feels that the primary job at this time is to get before the American public, as far as we possibly can, the basic facts in regard to the situation. Now, the Draper Committee is at work on what part of this program should be in economic aid and military aid. They are also heavily engaged in the study of organization, and they believe, I think, that they will report shortly with recommendations in regard to the way in which this program might be reorganized to be more efficient. And I think we all know that at times in the past it hasn't been too efficient. But that committee, appointed by the president for that specific purpose, is charged with that duty. We won't try to do their job.
You're just going to ride along then with whatever the administration suggests?
Oh, wait a minute, Mr. Edson. I'm representing the committee here today, but the opinions I express are my own personal opinions. And if I think the program that is put together doesn't make sense, I'll say so.
All right.
I hope and trust it will make sense, and I think it will. But merely because we banded ourselves together for the purpose of getting the general idea, the philosophy of the thing, across to the American people as much as we can help in doing so, doesn't mean that we abandon our American citizens' right to criticize.
You admit, then, that there are some things wrong, maybe, with this program that need correcting.
No program was ever put into effect by a democracy Certainly never by the American democracy that didn't have some things wrong with it. And it usually creaks at the joints, more or less. That's one of the penalties we pay for having a democratic system of government. I don't think merely for that reason we would want to turn over to totalitarian form. And by the same token, just because I think there have been errors in the program and faults in the past, I wouldn't abandon what I think is an essential part of our defense. I'd simply do the best that I could to help to make it sound.
Mr. Dale.
Dr. Bush, as you know, roughly half of the total program in the Mutual Security Bill is military aid. I'd like to quote to you from a critic of that portion of the program. It happens to be Brigadier General Bonner Fellers. The administration speaks of strong and well-armed forces around the Soviet perimeter. Whose forces? The 21 divisions in NATO, allied forces in Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Burma, Thailand? How ridiculous it is to pretend that strong and well-armed forces exist or will exist to, quote, hold these perimeter positions. That makes sense to me. Are we capable? Are these perimeter forces capable of resisting a thrust from the Soviet Union or China?
There are 5 million men under arms among our friends and our allies. I think that's a deterrent of some magnitude.
But if you specify it spot by spot, the Army of South Vietnam could not withstand an onslaught from the Chinese communists, surely.
No, and it wouldn't have to. But it would certainly make the Russian imperial program pause before they sailed into the forces in Vietnam if they knew that they were one of a great body of free nations, banded together for their common defense and bound to come to one another's support if attacked.
Isn't that surely the deterrent, the fact that we would come to their support, not their own divisions?
Of course it is. That's the essence of this whole affair. We do not believe in this country in a fortress America, of drawing into our shells and waiting for the inevitable. We're not a group of pessimists or defeatists. We believe that if the free nations of this world are banded together, with mutual security and mutual defense, defending the entire free world, that is a far better defense than any individual defense on our part could possibly be.
Including South Korea, but we keep giving them a couple of $100 million worth of military equipment each year. It seems to me that may be some money that we could save. It's our guarantee that saves South Korea, surely, not their tanks.
Yes, but you can't come to the support of a non-existent army.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Bush, what do you think would happen if we stopped within the next few years, as has been proposed, all foreign aid? Do you really think that the countries involved would give up their military establishment?
No, but
if they were on their own, or do you
think
they would
be
likely to...
I think it would be a calamity of the first water.
No, do you think they would be likely to strengthen their own military establishment?
No, I do not. I think that they would be thoroughly discouraged at the thought that we were abandoning this idea of mutual security. That in their discouragement, they might not be willing to stand up to the great Russian threat. It's only because they're allied with us, because all the free world is together on this thing, that they have the courage to stand up. I think it would be a calamity of the first water for us to put any terminus on this whatever. This plan, this aid must continue as long as the threat endures. You probably ask me next how long will the threat endure if I say
that. Well, I'm not going to ask you that. What I'm going to ask you is, why is the Soviet Union, which isn't much larger than we are, able to stand on its own? Why isn't Europe, which is almost the size, if it unites, the United States has almost as large a gross national product, has as many men, why can't they organize their own strength? Why must we constantly have to give them money?
This is the Soviet Union plus the Chinese communists that you're talking about. Every aggressor has the great advantage that he can strike where he will, and he can pick his own time. We, on the other hand, have to preserve the peace, and that is a far harder thing to do. We have done it thus far, and done it very successfully, in spite of the fact that Russia has tried to conquer the world and still says that it would conquer the world. Remember that before NATO was formed, Russia, by one means or another, had conquered Poland, Czechoslovakia, Lithuania, Romania, a dozen nations. Since we banded together under NATO, the progress of Russia in conquering Europe has ceased and stopped. Our object is to stop Russia in its tracks, to prevent war. And it is a far greater task to do that than to be in the middle, ready to perform an aggression, for the aggressor always has the advantage of surprise.
Well, now, Dr. Bush, you know something about our military strength, and you know something about nuclear weapons. Are you telling us here that NATO stopped the Russians in their tracks, or that our strategic air force, the power of our strategic air force, and the power of the nuclear weapons we have, stopped the Soviet Union in its tracks?
Well, I think personally that right after the war, the question that the Russians had in their mind as to how many nuclear weapons we might have in storage had a good deal to do with it. But beyond that, there are two or three elements in everything of this sort. So, of course, the strategic air force has been an important element. So have the ground forces in Europe. For the war, if it should come, an all-out war, may come in many ways. One would be a sudden all-out nuclear attack. Against that, we must be prepared at all times to so retaliate and to be able to retaliate in spite of a surprise attack that the Russians could not possibly dare to spring it. Another way that war might come would be by the Russians starting their armies rolling, not necessarily through the Low Countries, but into some part of Europe. They must be opposed by ground armies, for it is quite possible that that might start and no nuclear weapons be used on either side. We need to meet every threat.
Well, now, Dr. Bush, are you sure that if a nuclear war were threatened, that some of our allies wouldn't try to remain neutral, since they know that an attack, a nuclear attack by the Russians, would simply devastate them in no time at all? What was it Khrushchev said? 8 bombs and he'd destroy most of Western Europe?
Yes, I'm sure of it.
You're sure of what?
That they wouldn't remain neutral. I take you two kinds of wars. Suppose Russia suddenly sprung a nuclear attack on the free world. It would be over in a week or two. The question of whether we and our allies could retaliate at once would be the determining question of the outcome. There would be no time for any discussions except to get into the act as fast as possible. In the case of the ground armies trying to roll over Europe, would the European nations defend themselves? Of course they would. They're free people. They're as proud as we are. They have no intention of coming under the communist yoke.
Mr. Drummond.
Bush, I'd like to return to the problem of public opinion in this program, because it seems to me that the very existence of your committee is evidence of your own anxiety that there is a decline of public support. Now, we at this table know full well that you're not one who accepts the opinion of our military leaders just out of hand and uncritically. You insist upon an independent judgment. And I'm wondering if you're not minimizing the danger of having a increasing opposition to this program because the country is not getting enough information about the military program in order to know whether it's serving its purpose or not. And you're asking us sort of to take the military opinion...
I've said before that there are secrets that you and I will certainly agree can't be told to the Russians.
I wouldn't question that.
I also know that it is quite possible to give the American people a grasp of this sort of a situation without invading the secret realms on the basis of information that is properly available. And if the American people don't, under those circumstances, understand this thing, it's your fault, not mine, because you're in that business, and I ought to ask you the question, I think.
Well, I would say that our problem is getting adequate documented information on the operation of the military program. And I think there are many who've studied this program
who agree with our experience that enough facts aren't being made available. And since you asked the question, I take the liberty of answering it and passing.
Mr. Edson.
I want to get back to this committee of yours. About the same time your committee appeared, there was another organization announced as Citizens for Foreign Aid with Walter Harnischfeger of Milwaukee as its head.
Yes?
Are you going to take Mr. Harnischfeger on and debate?
Well, I don't think so.
Why not? Isn't that the way
to... have if I were going into a debate, a better debater to go up against. In my opinion, this committee of his hasn't thus far made much sense.
Well,
they say they give prescribe a dozen ways for us to draw ourselves into a shell, abandon our allies, go back into Fortress America, and then they end up by saying they're not isolationists. I can't make them out.
Well, if you're trying to get the facts before the people, isn't the way to do that to debate it out and have it out with him? He gives other facts about our economic situation. You say we can afford to do this and more. And he said that one quarter of our national debt now is due to foreign aid. 20% of our taxes go to foreign aid.
Which also isn't true.
And, these are the things that you have to clear up. General Draper himself, whom you quoted, says only 51% of the people are for this program.
Well, in a democracy, that's enough, but I hope it'll be 55 soon, and it'll be 75 before the discussion is over.
Mr. Dale.
Dr. Bush, you said, as have others, that this program is going to have to continue as long as the threat endures, and the threat you're speaking of course, is the Soviet threat, the Cold War. Well, I'm sure you're aware, though many people are not, perhaps, that about three-quarters of our economic aid goes still in the form of cash grants, cash or commodity grants, to some 15 countries around the world, of whom a great number are not really related to the Cold War at all. Jordan, Bolivia, Libya, South Vietnam, South Korea, Formosa, Pakistan, Turkey, Laos, Cambodia. Well, they're the main ones. The Marshall Plan came to an end because it could accomplish a job. But is there any end in sight to this subsidy aid, which takes a shade over $1 billion a year just to keep these countries going?
Let me answer that question in two parts. And the first one is, really, how long do we have to keep this up?
That's right.
And I say as long as the threat continues.
But now, the threat to Jordan?
There's a point there that I'd like to get in before I answer your second question, which is this. How long will the threat endure? The reason that Russia has been able to build an A-bomb, that has been able to put a Sputnik in orbit, is because they imitated us. At the end of the war, I was perfectly sure that the laboratories of Russia, commissar-ridden, ruled by political hacks, could not possibly compete with our free institutions. They learned their lesson. Today, their laboratories are just as free as ours are, and their scientists just as free as ours. And it's because of the giving of that freedom that they are able to perform as they have. Now, you cannot give freedom to a part of a people and not all of a people. You cannot give freedom to a group and hold the rest in slavery. In this way, there will be a change in the Russian system, not for any comfort of ours at the moment, but as a basis for real hope for our children.
Dr. Bush, however, if the Cold War disappeared tomorrow, according to the people who run the foreign aid program, we would have to continue a very substantial program of economic bailout, is the best way I can call it, for Tunisia, Morocco, Bolivia, Jordan, Libya, countries that are not related to the Cold War. Is this going to have to continue?
I don't say that. I say as long as the threat continues. Now, the threat is in several parts, as you know. A threat of all-out war such as we face today in connection with Berlin. And also the threat of conquering of countries by continual subversion. And we cannot afford to have Russian-allied totalitarian states all over the world. And there's a very important point there. Communism does not prosper on just the existence of poverty. What determines whether communism can get a hold or not is whether there is progress. If there is opportunity, if the scale of living, however low, is improving, the communists can't do a thing. And a very few dollars, compared to our wealth, can make the difference in the country between their having hope for the future and having the type of discouragement and poverty that makes them ripe for communist infiltration.
Mr. Spivak.
Every time anybody wants to spend some money, we're told that this is necessary to our survival. The President's Science Advisory Committee urged that we double what we're spending for education, from $18 billion to $36 billion. Do you think that's necessary for our survival?
No, I don't think it's necessary as a survival, but as an old teacher, I certainly hope that we'll find some way of raising teachers' salaries in this country.
Do you think we can spend $18 billion here without going bankrupt?
Look, we aren't going bankrupt, Mr. Spivak. We aren't going to go broke, and we aren't going to have inflation. This country, since 1939, has more than doubled its product.
Dr. Bush, I think on that happy note, I'm going to have
I'm
to
sorry,
interrupt.
Because I'm sorry, like to really tell this fellow something about it, but I guess I'll have
I wish we had time. Thank you very much, Dr. Bush, for being with us.
Ann Monitor joins in thanks to Dr. Vannevar Bush and the members of the Meet the Press panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. And now, this personal word, if I may. Your child, every child, deserves and must have a first-rate education, themes in which the Meet the Press panel was just talking. The very future of our nation is linked with the quality of education provided for our children. The achievement of this quality will cost money, but for the future security of America, it'll be worth every cent we may be asked to spend upon it. To achieve this quality, our standards must be raised, and these include standards of teaching ability, teacher prestige and status, revised curricula, student achievement goals, awareness of and planning for the gifted children, parental supervision and stimulation, as well as overall increased respect for intellectual attainment. Today, better schools mean first-rate schools. We owe our children a quality education. For complete information on how you and your community can work for first-rate schools, write Better Schools Incorporated at 9 East 40th Street, 9 East 40th Street, New York 16, New York. And thank you. 5 minutes of news coming up. Monitor continues. But for me, for this week, time's run out. So this is Ben Grauer saying thank you and good night.
This is Monitor, the NBC Weekend Radio Service.